The following message was given by Benjamin Ray in the fall of 1957.
I went from country to country. As soon as my plane would land, I would start talking Spanish to the population, about 25% of that, to hire these people to lie to me, to kowtow to me, to tell me that I love you, American. Who wouldn't? For a price. Unconverted man, unconverted woman would do that for a price. I think you Americans are wonderful. We went into the hotels where sometimes the waiters would sneer at us because they didn't have too much contact with the American people. We didn't pay as much for the hotel room either, by the way. There was method to our madness. All right, another purpose of the trip. As head of the Spanish department, I searched throughout these Spanish-speaking countries for books that can be used in getting the gospel to these people. I looked for histories that would prove to them definitely that the Catholic Church had changed the Sabbath, that they were observing the same day for Christmas that was observed in Babylon many thousands of years before Christ, or at least 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. I looked for books that would prove to them that they were descendants of Tarshish and Tyrus. I looked for books of any description that would help us in getting this gospel across. Because they will say, that is a Protestant Bible and I cannot believe it. But you take a comic book and put the imprimatur of the Catholic Church in there, it will be doctored. Now these history books that I was looking for were books that had the imprimatur of the Catholic Church in there. Then it was gospel as far as the Catholic people are concerned. But let me point out this to you. The Catholic Church has been very, very skillful in burning, in hiding, in destroying all of this knowledge that will be useful to us in order to convince these people. I found one book that dealt with ecclesiastical history in South America that possibly may be of help to me. And it was the Spanish translation of the Council of Trent. Nothing more. I also found a few history books that you could get in Mexico, and otherwise I was at a loss for books. The only good that I got out of looking for books was talking to the people and also the exercise of walking from bookstore to bookstore. Now, another reason. I have to compare dialects of Spanish. I had to compare dialects of the Spanish language. You know yourself, in this country, we speak 48 brands of English. Every state has its peculiar idiom. It has its peculiar dialect. New York has one, Texas has another. California has another. And all the shades of dialects in between and intonation. I went from country to country. As soon as my plane would land, I would start talking Spanish to the population. And before I was there 3 or 4 days, I would get the outstanding peculiarities of the language. For example, those of you who know some Spanish, the word calle, C-A-L-L-E, is pronounced calle in Mexico and all the rest of the Spanish-speaking world. It means street. In Argentina, it's called calle. Notice the difference in the pronunciation. Well, that was one of the objectives that I had in mind when I landed in Argentina, was to master this sound of the double L and the Y that's different from the other nations. And Mr. Ted Armstrong and I became so proficient in the use of this double L and Y before we left, they couldn't tell where we were from at all. They would guess Argentines, Uruguayans, and so forth. Now, I'm not saying that to brag. I thank God that I have that ability. Now, another purpose was to lay the foundation for the radio broadcast in South America. I interviewed stations from north of South America to south of South America. Each country has its own peculiar laws and certain things that it will permit be said. And it was definitely useful that we go to these stations and talk to the managers and to the disc jockeys and to the personnel of the station. We have a lot of valuable material that you're going to be reading in The Plain Truth and the various articles that Mr. Armstrong has written and one that I am writing. We also are going to be able to use this information that we gain in the years to come in reaching these people. Now, I covered personally 10 countries I covered Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, and Venezuela. 10 countries. In each of these countries, I looked for 5 things. I looked first for Axis activity. I mean by Axis activity, the activity of the German and the Italian. The German and the Italian. Why look at the activity of the Italian? After all, it is to be a resurrection of the Roman Empire, isn't it? Tying Italian activity to the German activity, you can get a picture of the two most potent powers that will be in the beast power. Tying the German industrial know-how to the Italian love of beauty and design, and you can have an unbeatable combination as far as the selling of items is concerned. I mention a case in point. The Volkswagen, a little German car, totally German in itself. It's an ugly little thing, very efficient, very economical to drive that car. And they have had an Italian design another body to be used on that motor, and you come out with a Carmine Ghia, which is a thing of beauty. It is mechanically perfect, it's economical to drive, and it is selling. They can't keep up with the orders. This is just one case in point. There are many others. Now, you do know that Italy and West Germany are in this pact that was signed in Europe in the early spring. This trading pact of 5 or 6 nations to form a customs-free territory in Europe. These two countries will probably dominate the system over there. Now, I think I'll mention here the racial descent of the Italians, which will tie in. You've all read Mr. Hayes' article on the races. The northern Italians, the ones that are fairer than the others, belong to the Chaldean. And after all, it's a Chaldean system, isn't it, that we're living in. The Italians have given more to the world in the way of art and music than any other race and culture. These people, having the Chaldean know-how and with the German love of efficiency and the drive, as I said before, is an unbeatable combination. Now, I looked also for the industrial activity in all of these countries, and I'm going to mention them specifically later on. The economic life, what it was like, was it strong, was it weak, was it faltering, and so forth. What did the government have to draw on the import-export bank for its resources? Then personal incidences, I want you to keep these in mind, that happened to me to show you what is going on down there. I also ask the question, can we bring the gospel here? Because this is the thing. This is the ultimate. This is what they need so sorely. Now, let me go country by country. I'm going to go rather rapidly, so you take notes as you will. I landed in Panama. Panama is a hot box. It's just like stepping out of an air-conditioned room into a boiling cauldron. Because it's very hot there, very humid, your clothes cling to you. You begin to perspire immediately. I walked into the customs at the head of the line. They called me last because it was an American. At the head of the line, I was the first man off the plane. Walked into the customs. They called me last because I was an American. They called the Panamanians first and all the other races, then the Americans. And, of course, they called them alphabetically, and I was last there because my name is way down in the alphabet. I went on into town, checked in the hotel, and it was the same thing we found. I think most of you know that the Panamanians are a mixture of Negro and Spanish. The Negro predominates there. They speak a Spanish that's off, but they also speak English as well as they do Spanish. They make fun of us by giving you an attitude, well, what are you doing here? They have accused us openly to me, saying, why do you Americans steal nearly $33 million from Panama every year? I said, why? You have our canal, they say. You collect $35 million a year from fees. You give us $1,900,000. Isn't that stealing? I said, no, we earned it. We as American people earned it. Look, I pointed out, you in Panama have the best roads, the best streets. You have a pure drinking water system. You can go to the faucet there and drink water out of it without fear of getting dysentery or typhoid fever. I said, why? He didn't answer. I said because the American engineers have come here and have engineered your water system. They have laid your streets. They have made your roads for you. And I said, we pay you amply for the canal and give you free service for all of your ships. Or it's a reduced rate, I think. It is rather than free. I went to downtown Panama City, and I stayed down there for a while, walking around the streets. They're filthy in every respect. Look like they haven't been swept in years. The stores are run down. They sell cheap, shoddy merchandise in them. So about dark, I started back to the hotel because, I didn't want to be out there by myself at night without any purpose of being there. So I took a taxi, and this driver took me way out into the bush. I don't know what his intentions were, but I know one thing. That was the hardest prayer that had ever been said in the backseat of that taxi cab. But immediately, I saw him turn. He came back to the hotel. Well, nothing really happened in that country to report to you other than what I have reported to you. So I'm going to go on to Colombia. I had a friend that I attended Louisiana State University with. In fact, he was my roommate from Colombia. He belonged to the Nazi Party during the Second World War. In fact, he kidded me about being so foolish as to fight against such a good system. He said if the German government had conquered, we would have gone through, he said we, because he was a member of the party, we would have gone through the world, we would have killed the blind, we would have killed the cripple, we would have made the world a better place through our efforts. The German culture would have been superior. We, the United States, would have been in a subordinate position. Let me pause here to point out a few things in geopolitics that they had planned to do if they had conquered the world. They had planned, first, to establish the German throughout the world as the leading rulers and the leading overlords of the population. The Swedes, the Scandinavians, the Danes were under those and next in rank because they're Germanic. Underneath them would have come the English-speaking people because they are of a Germanic race also, according to their way of thinking. Of course, we know that these people I just mentioned are all Israelites. They are not Germanic. Next would come the Spanish-speaking people and the Latins. Under that strata, you would have the Negro. Under that last man on the bottom of the heap would be the Jew. That was the way they had the society planned. They were to go around through the world killing off the marginal element of the population. The people that have to have assistance to live. The old, the maimed, the blind. That is the system that they were planning for us. God saw to it that we didn't get it. Now, I went to Colombia to see this man, to talk to him, because I knew that if Hitler landed in Colombia, he would have known about it, and I believe he would have told me. But, unknown to me, Mr. Armstrong had forbidden us to look for Hitler when we went to South America. And it's possible that God intervened to keep me from being injured there, because I couldn't find this man. And had I started asking him questions, it possibly could have been dangerous. Now, I'm guessing. I don't know. But I couldn't find him. So I walked through the city streets of Cali for 2 or 3 days there, talking to people and getting the Colombian attitude towards us. They hate us, but not so much as they do in the capital of Colombia. There is some American business activity. But on the way in, as the plane landed there, I began to see more and more German element. I heard the first language that I heard in Colombia was German. It was not Spanish. Then the next language I heard was English, and then the next was Italian. Then, of course, Spanish being spoken around. All the hotels are owned by German and Italian. All the communications are run by German and Italian. The factories are run by Americans, German, and Italian, and a few Colombians. I had no instances here that would show me that they personally hate me. But they have told us that the minute that you give Panama back to the canal back to Panama, then that is the day that we declare war on Panama and take it away because you stole it from us in the first place. How many of you know the history of the Panama Canal and how we got it? Very few of you, I presume. But Panama, the Isthmus of Panama, belonged to a nation called Gran Granada, or La Nueva Granada, I think it was called at one time, the New Granada. And we engineered a revolution in Panama, shoved our fleet into both sides of the Isthmus, landed Marines and says, Colombia, stay out. We're going to guarantee the independence of the Isthmus. Because we had made an agreement with the revolutionary leaders that they would give us rights in the canal if we would guarantee their independence. So we did steal the canal from Colombia, didn't we? Effectively stole that canal from us. But it would have come to us one way or the other anyway. We'd probably jump the gun in grabbing gateways, because God promised Abraham the gateways of the enemies, and this is one of the major gateways. It would have come to us eventually, but we had to make enemies in getting it in order to establish this thing that will eventually cause us to fall. I only saw one person on the street that actually hissed at me as I passed by. That didn't matter. I could have bristled up as I would have a couple, 3 or 4 years ago, and I'd say, "Look here, buddy, why did you do that?" But if you do things like that, the jails are pretty nasty in South America. So I remembered that I was a Christian and continued on my way. That's the best thing to do in a case like that. Well, Kali is located between the central and the western cordillera of the Andes Mountains, located at the fork where the two mountains come together. The city is sitting back in the hillside and down into the valley, and the streets are narrow all one way, very, very dimly lighted. And so I didn't venture out too much at night, although I did some. Not too much. I kept on the main streets where people were passing now and then. But and I would stop and talk to people, like newsboys and things that were trying to sell me something, you see, on the streets. I wouldn't stop a passerby and talk to him. Well, I left Colombia and crossed over the Andes into the capital of Ecuador called Quito. I stepped off the plane and I gasped for breath because it was so cold up there. It was very chilly. It was also very high. My heart began to hurt almost immediately. It was about a mile and a half, close to 2 miles high, above the level of the sea. The oxygen is so rare up there that you can't walk very rapidly. You lie down, your bed seems to tilt because you're gasping for breath. Your corpuscles are crying out for oxygen. Your fingernails turn blue. I had some very nice experiences here. First, I called the station called HCJB, the Voice of the Andes. It's a Protestant station that operates there in Quito. I thought it was a Seventh-day Adventist station, so I called them up as soon as I got there. I said, "May I have the privilege of coming down to your radio station?" He said, "Who are you?" I told him. I said, "I'm very interested in the gospel and the effect it's having here in South America." He said, "By all means, come." Then I said, "Are you Adventist?" And he said, "No, we are Christian." He said, "Anyone who keeps anyone who keeps the Sabbath is not a Christian." So I said, "Oh." But nevertheless, I wanted to go down and see. So I went down to the station. I talked to them at length, talked to several ministers. I listened to them make a broadcast in Spanish and one in Swedish. They broadcast shortwave from this HCJV in Quito all the way to Europe, to all the countries in Europe. It's a Protestant station. They start out with soft music, you know, all of that. It's very ineffective. I asked him, "How many letters do you get a week?" He said, "Well, it varies, but up to about 60. And so you can see that that's not very effective. We get sometimes 3,000 or 4,000 a week, isn't it? Mr. Meredith, about 3,000 or 4,000 letters a week? Yes, sir. Some weeks 25,000. So you can see the difference in the programs. Mr. Armstrong comes out and says, "Greetings, friends," you see? You catch the interest almost immediately. But they come out with this soft music, and the people switch them off. I learned something here. I learned how not to do it, you see? I saw some of the other activities that they were doing there, and it's doing nothing but confusing these poor, mixed-up people there in Ecuador. Now, I went over to a bookshop. It was run by a German. He had been in Ecuador about, oh, I don't recall the number of years. I have it written down at the office. But he escaped from Hitler's Germany. He came over to Ecuador and established his business there. And he did give me some contacts in Spain and parts of Europe where I may be able to find these books that I want. Although he may not, he said he could, may not be able to get them himself, but they might be able to furnish them to me, you see. He told me some other significant things. I saw that his German pride was on his shoulder, and he was very ready to boast about it. He hated Hitler with a passion, but he loved Germany. So I said to him, "Are there many German people here?" He said, "Wee." "Yes, all over the place, you see." I said, "Do you have any sort of club? Do you have a German club?" "Oh, sure. We have a Pan-German club," he said. "A Pan-German club. How many of you know what the Pan-German club is? You do. You should know back there. Pan-German club is this. It is a club of German people that are promoting German interests for a united German government all over the world. Wherever there is German blood, there, according to them, is Germany. Wherever a German walks, that area becomes a part of Germany. It has many objectives: to promote German interests and promote the German ideology, the German way of life, and German culture, and to keep the German in that particular area free from contact with the other part, being polluted by the culture of that particular country. Well, I thought this was very significant, and I have this man's address. He told me I could write him and ask him any question I wanted to about anything in Ecuador. And so I'm going to take advantage of that one of these days. Remind him that I'm one of his customers. All right? Let's go on, then, into Peru. Peru is bustling with activity. The nationality of the Germans maintain a separate section of the city of Lima. They have their own schools, their own churches, their own radio stations, their own cafes, their own restaurants, their own clubs. How many of you noticed the name of Miss Universe this year? She's from Peru. Her name is Gladys Zinder. She's German. She's not Spanish. She's Peruvian, sure. But she's German. This is one of the most powerful nations on the west coast of South America. The United States at the present time is building a submarine fleet for Peru. They have, I think, 8 or 9 submarines that we have given to them or sold to them at half price. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, a submarine was turned over to Peru, one of the latest snorkel-type submarines. The headlines in Chile. I was there. I read them. It said, invasion in 10 years. I read down in the paper, and it says that while the United States builds up this fleet for Peru, it endangers Chilean liberty because Chile cannot maintain a large navy and a large army. Whereas Peru has oil, it has other minerals that are very valuable, it has the friendship of the United States and everything else. The United States builds this thing there that will be a help to the German beast power as it rises up in Europe. We can also broadcast here. I found that out very, very well and very freely from Radio Miraflores, that's just outside of Lima and will cover all the populated areas of the country, of Peru. Let's go then on to Chile. Chile is 3,000 miles long and about 60 or 70 miles wide in its widest place. They call it the Shoestring Republic. Hot and dry in the north because they have an area up there that it never rains in. There is no vegetation. The people that live up there paint their houses green in order to break the monotony. But it's a very valuable region because you get your nitrates, your other pyrites and things of that nature, gold and silver from that particular region of Chile. It's one of the most valuable areas as far as Chilean commerce is concerned. The central area is something like California up to the Oregon border. And the southern area is like Washington, and Oregon is on the west coast of Oregon. Green, evergreen trees, and with a lot of rain. In Chile, you have a great deal of economic inactivity there. The people are hungry. The people are starving in some areas. I read one account in the newspaper there where the people were eating rats and dogs because they didn't have anything else to eat. Well, if you stop to think about it, a dog is about as good to eat as a hog. It's a good source of protein, although it won't digest. But they are actually eating them in southern Chile because they have not been able to produce enough to carry them through the winters. All right? I looked around Chile for books and for industrial activity. I found many German-speaking people here, but there are not as many here as in Peru and other sections of South America. Why? Because Chile is a poor country. There are certain areas that Chile does have rich activity, like in Concepcion, for example, one of the largest cities of southern Chile. The Germans are thick there. And in Valdivia, and Puerto Montt, and all the way down south into South Chile. In Concepcion, a man told me that Ernst Messerschmitt is there. Ernst Messerschmitt is the nephew of Willie. If you want to call him Wiley Messerschmitt, be all right, because he is that. Mr. Messerschmitt controls the only real fishing fleet off the coast of Chile. It plies all up and down the western coast of South America up to the Panama Canal. This in itself is very dangerous to us because fishing ships chart waters. They also can be converted into small gunboats to run other interference for other ships. It can be converted into mine carriers and so forth. This man that I was talking to told me that Mr. Messerschmitt would go on a binge every now and then. He would walk down the streets of Concepcion saying, "Sieg Heil!" We were gypped. The Americans have done this to us. He's talking about Germany, of course. He's an unconverted Nazi still. He hasn't learned his lesson. Well, while waiting for Mr. Armstrong, I took a train trip right down through the heart of Chile, down to Valdivia. This is the capital of the German-speaking country. I stepped off the train about midnight into a dense fog. It's very cold, very foggy. I had no reservations, so I could envision myself sleeping on a park bench, if I could find a park bench in that fog, 8,500 miles away from home. Well, another time I prayed in the taxi. I got a hotel reservation, a hotel room too, very nice one. Call it coincidence if you will, but I prefer to call it an answered prayer. Very nice room. And I found out a great many things about the area while I was there. This was the area where I wrote Milstead the letter that was read here in church. So I won't go into detail here in this church about that because now you know what the countryside is like there. It was dreary at night. It was beautiful about 3 hours a day when the sun would make the fog dissipate and then you could take a few pictures to walk around. You could see what the country was like. And I will tell you briefly, it's like Oregon around Portland. It's beautiful, it's green, it sparkles. But the ever-present fog comes in at night and it chokes out practically all life. It seemed like the city dies. You can hear these newsboys chanting their wares all day long and practically all night long in the fog. And it is really lonesome there. It was for me. I walked into a bookstore there and I said to the lady, "You have certain books." I had the titles with me that I wanted to get, and she said, "No, I'm sorry, sir. Did you want them in Spanish or German?" I said, "Spanish." And she said, "We don't have them." I probably could have gotten them in German. I didn't ask her, though, because I didn't know the German name, you see. But then I said to her, "Do you have any books on geopolitics either in German, Spanish, or English?" She said, "No. We don't have anything like that." I've been looking for German geopolitics books for many years. They were all confiscated and burned after the war. It's another era we made. This country made that era. So I haven't been able to find those either. But she became, she was like a clam. She closed up after I mentioned these geopolitics books because these people know that. They know that they have been watched. But they are, let me point out another thing here about these German people. They are not aware of their role yet. There are a few people in Germany, the leaders that are planning all of this with the man on the street like you and I, they have no concept whatsoever what's going on. Certain little things like that that they have been warned about. These German geopolitics books, they're nasty, you see. Not really, but they in the political ideologies, they're not to be spoken of. Well, I'm going to return with you now up to Santiago where I waited for Mr. Armstrong to arrive. There, I didn't see too much. I didn't interview too many important people until he was there because I wanted him to be there with me when I did the interviewing or when we did the interviewing. So when he arrived, I was very happy to see him. Needless to say, we started out almost immediately to do the job that we had been sent there for. I interviewed several people regarding radio time. Then we took a trip in a taxi about 175 miles, cost of $3, one way. $3 another way. Went over to Valparaiso. There was a fleet of Navy ships there that had invaded the whole central portion of Chile. We took pictures of the fleet. We took pictures of sailors. We also were able to read the accounts in the papers there. They referred to the sailors there as rats in some of them. American sailors I'm talking about. When the sailors arrived in Santiago, the price of the dollar went down until you could only buy about 550 pesos with $1. Before they arrived, I paid $1 for 700 pesos. Prices in the stores went up. The sailors were well received on the streets. The girls would come up to them on the street and start talking to them. Apparently nice girls. I don't know what their object was. Some of them out of friendliness, nothing more. Men would stop them and try to offer them services on the street. But in the newspapers, you would see the accounts. One paper said, "We are being invaded by North American." They have a word down there called Manawa. It's a corruption of an English word meaning man of war. It's a disrespectful term that they use to refer to some military pomp or some pompous military man. So these American men of war have landed. They've invaded. They're taking over our girls. They're insulting Chileans on the street. They dance to rock and roll all night long. They even coined the word for rock and roll while I was there. They would take pictures of sailors, drunken sailors. I have one at my home in Pasadena with his tongue hanging out. He's dancing a rock and roll. He's so drunk he doesn't know where he is. And this was flashed on the front page of one of the papers there. He was dancing with a prostitute. These were the glorious American college boys that were sent on a 6 weeks tour of duty with the Navy. These are the future fathers of America. I didn't say farmers, I said fathers of America. These are the people that build the friendship or tear it down in these foreign countries as they land. They represent you and me as an American, but not as church people. One newspaper said these Americans are so simple. They're just like a stalk of corn waving in the wind. In other words, vacillating. And the stalk of corn was like this. The tassel of the corn is blonde, usually, and the Americans were compared to that because they would vacillate so much. They had no opinion, in other words, on anything. They lacked wisdom, and they tried to convince the Chileans that they were lovers of Chile and all that, all the time they were going out doing these things. One sign in a store window there was a drawing by an artist. It had a sailor in American uniform. It didn't say anything about Americans underneath it. It said that some people say that Chilean men never take baths. Now, I don't know how that came about. But it was there. You could see it was an American sailor, and it was given that slant. That some people say that the Chilean men never take baths. Now, I don't know. This man was probably mistreated by one sailor, and he judged the whole fleet by that one man. When Mr. Armstrong arrived, we immediately made plans to cross over the Andes into Argentina. But there was one important interview that we wanted to make before we really left. So we made that, then we made plans, and I'll tell you more about that later. But this interview was with a commanding officer of the Chilean Army. I know the Chilean consul here in Los Angeles very well, and she gave me the address of this man who is her nephew. She had a letter of introduction. We walked into the base. There we were accosted by the guard. His uniform was a pale blue, had all the markings on the Wehrmacht uniform that was used by the German army in the Second World War. He interviewed us for a little bit and asked us all about our business and where we were from and so forth, so we could take all this to the commanding officer. It was top secret thing. Well, the man sent out word that he could see us within 5 minutes. I had the letter that I sent in to him from his aunt here in the United States. Something came up, though, before we could get to see him. He was called into the capital for some business. I don't know what it was, but we did wait 5 minutes, and the man came back and told us that the commanding officer couldn't see us that afternoon. He could see us the next day. Well, we had already planned this trip to Valparaiso before that, so we couldn't stay. But we did talk to this sergeant. He was a cocky little man. I remarked to him, "Your uniform looks German to me." He stood up straight. "Yes, our whole system is German. Very proud of the fact." I said, "Even your commands, your orders are given in German? I mean, you know, like about face and all of that, the drill?" He said, "Yes. Because Spanish doesn't lend itself to the military life." Can you imagine someone saying, "Atención"? It's a soft, musical language. So they either use English or they use German to give these commands. And the Chilean army uses the
German command because it's more force, has more force behind it. I pointed out to him, I saw him getting a little bit overbearing in his attitude. I said, your uniforms may be German, your system may be German, but what about your equipment? It's American, isn't it? He blushed and said yes. He couldn't give any answer because you have these big 5x5s, these two Jeeps and all of those. The rifles that they were carrying were M1s and Browning automatic and the American sidearms. So I pointed out to him, not get so cocky, young man. Your equipment is from us. And it was given to them, by the way. We gave them the equipment, which will probably be used against us. Not so much as the Europeans, but it will be used against us. Well, we had made plans to leave for Argentina, and the plane was 13 hours late. We had to leave our hotel by a certain time, so we went out to the airport at 1:30 in the morning. The airport in Santiago, although it's the capital of one of the republics, is a tin barn. It had four little kerosene stoves in the four corners of the room. The doors were wide open, the windows were wide open, and it was about 20 below. Mr. Armstrong and I had raincoats, but we didn't have overcoats. We literally sat on those heaters to get warm. I took a very, very bad cold, renewed a very, very bad cold, I better say, because I had had one, and Mr. Armstrong came, and he anointed me, and I got over it promptly. But then I took another, standing out there, and I suffered for the next week or so with it. Mr. Armstrong caught a cold there, also. We had to wait until 5 o'clock to get out of that airport, that miserable airport. We took off over the Andes Mountains to Argentina. When we landed in Argentina, the change was miraculous. The country was well kept, the countryside, you could see that. Herds of cattle grazing on the pampa, which is a beautiful sight. It's a plain, level plain, with grass growing, cattle grazing, farmhouses here and there in it. The airport was about a 5-story building with a swimming pool in front of it, well kept, well managed. It had an Italian name. We knew that we'd arrived in Peron's land. There was a freeway leading from the airport into the capital. The streets were well kept, although rather the construction of the street, I mean, it was well kept in repair. But the houses, the garbage had not been collected. It was dirty all along the way. We started out to look almost immediately for Nazi activity here because we knew names in this country of Nazi bigwigs that had been there, that had planned things to hide the German machine in Argentina. We knew names that we could ask about. We were given definite answers about these people. We knew that the Mercedes-Benz company, for example, had planned the financial policy of the Perón regime. We knew that certain military men had left Germany, had come over to Argentina, had taken over control of the army in Argentina and of the navy and the air force there. We could ask about these men personally. So we did. These were not Hitler. These men were not Hitler, so we could ask about them. Mr. Armstrong had not said anything about that. We interviewed industrialists there, which you're going to read about, so I won't go into detail about it. Argentina is on the upswing. They are almost ready to have a revolution right now to reestablish another Nazi government there. Now, you will probably say, Argentina is a very small Latin American country. What importance does it have? Did you really realize that Argentina is one of the 10 trading nations of the world? The top 10 trading nations of the world? It ranks 7th or 8th of the top 10 trading nations. It fluctuates its position. It's at our doorstep. It has given over control to Germans and German Nazi Party members there. They will not permit us to use the facilities of broadcasting companies there to broadcast the gospel. They will allow no personal freedom when this thing comes back into power there. They will reinstate these German officers that were kicked out when Perón was kicked out. And all of this may be painting a pretty black picture of Argentina. It has its brighter side. We did enjoy the food here very much. There's beef, prime beef, in every restaurant you go into. We had steaks 3 1/4 inches thick. We measured them. Had a little ruler. And we measured the steaks 3 1/4 inches thick. Done to a turn, they would bring out a slice of butter about like that. It had been mixed with lemon juice and chopped up parsley and watercress. and that was reformed and sliced. You'd put that on your steak, and this butter would dribble down into this meat and would make it so delicious that it would melt in your mouth.
50 cents. I gained a couple pounds here.
Didn't cost much to eat. Well, I'm going to rush on because my time is running out here. We crossed over to Uruguay, and I think here we really accomplished something that will bear fruit in, well, next year, almost immediately. We interviewed a man in the radio station there who was the manager of the company. He said that we could get on there, on the station in Montevideo. But he said, at the present time, I can't promise you anything. He was noncommittal about it. But I said, now look, we do not want to contract time with you at the present time because we have agents in New York that will do it for us when we get ready, and when we get ready and you can make time for us. We will contract through you. We do no business with you personally. The purpose of the trip was to know the man, to get his attitude, his reactions to it, and let him know us. We emphasize that the World Tomorrow program does not ask for money on the air. We emphasize that it was not the ordinary broadcast that deals with soft, smooth things. It was a dynamic thing as I told him. A dynamic thing that tried to interpret, that did interpret, I didn't say try, that did interpret the events of the day and tie those events with what the Bible says in order to tell what's coming. I said this was the very same gospel that Christ preached. And we emphasized the fact that it was different, and he was very, very cordial to us and all of that, and it will bear fruit because when I returned to New York, Mr. Armstrong called me to New York with him, and he gave me permission to go ahead and establish contact with that station through our agent. We will start broadcasting, if God wills, in the first week in January of this coming year in Montevideo. Montevideo there, the station from Montevideo, reaches this great metropolis of Buenos Aires, Rio de la Plata. There's a city called that, or just La Plata sometime. Then it, of course, Montevideo, Asunción, southern Brazil. In fact, there are about 9 or 10 million people living in that area. I don't know exactly, but I can tell you the precise number. It broadcasts from two bands, a standard and a shortwave band. We'll utilize both of them, same price, $30 a week, very cheap. Now, this actually paid off our going there. Uruguay is a stable country. The people are more like we are. They're a different tribe of the house of Tarsus. Different tribe altogether. You can see it in their faces. In other words, they sprang from a different son of Tarsus. They speak Spanish about like the other people do in that area. But they have never had a revolution. We're thinking that if the broadcast goes over there and the work warrants it, we will establish an office there and send one of our men to maintain the office there for all South America. Food is good, prices are reasonable, and it's a healthful climate, and there is no instability in the government. They will permit tapes to come in too, which is another thing from the United States that some of these countries will not permit. And records if we have to send them in. All right, let's move along to Brazil. We took off from Montevideo, went to Brazil, and we landed in the city called Sao Paulo. S-A-O-P-A-U-L-O. This is the industrial center of Brazil. The city itself is 14 years old. The downtown section is 14 years old. It was cleaned out, a new city was built. Modernistic freeways going this way and that way all across town. Big parks, wide streets, modernistic buildings with great amount of color and glass in their architecture. Industrial activity all over the city. There was one Italian family that we heard out there that owned 350 industrial companies in the southern portion of Brazil that were headquartered in Sao Paulo. German companies, Opel, Mercedes, DKW, and chemical companies were being established all the time. American companies were just barely holding their own there. We knew that Krupp had contracted to build a steel mill, one of the largest steel mills in South America, out from Sao Paulo. We went out. We took pictures of that. You will see them in The Plain Truth. We could say we've been there when this beast was fabricating his plans to rise up and conquer us. The second language of Sao Paulo is not Portuguese. It is, I mean, not English. You see, the first language is Portuguese. The second language is German. You will be understood if you speak Spanish or English. But it's better to speak German or Portuguese. I rode downstairs in the hotel with six German businessmen at once. I was the only foreigner there, really. These people are coming to this area to establish their business because business is being done there. On the other hand, when we got to Rio, where pleasure is being done, pleasure is being had, what race do you think we found there? The Americans. They were loud. They were obnoxious. Some of them were nice. We were Americans. We were nice. We think we were. Maybe they thought we were obnoxious. I don't know. But it was just to show you the contrast there. I was never so disappointed in any city in my life as I was in Rio. It had been built up through propaganda and study as one of the world's leading cities. Beautiful in every respect, clean, and from the air it looked like a jewel, nestling around the mountains, the various mountains around the bays. But as we landed, the streets were dirty, filled with a mixed population. Now this is where integration has not paid off. The Negro in Brazil was freed about 50 years before he was in this country. They have intermingled with the Portuguese, and they have come out with something that you don't know what it is. Mr. Armstrong and I saw more demon-possessed people in Brazil. We saw more deformed people in Brazil than any other country in South America. Now, you say, but can the mixing of races do that? Frankly, I don't know. It could be a combination of things. It could be bad diet that would cause the deformity, and plain immorality that would cause the demon possession. We saw men and women walking down the streets like that, that were jerking, with some of them with fits. Now, this is not a common sight, but he being a minister and I being with him, we actually noticed those things more than the average person would. Well, we were glad to get out of this country. I was very disappointed in Brazil, with the exception of Sao Paulo. We flew to Caracas on our way north, coming back, over about 3,500 miles up the world's biggest jungle. We made no stops. We landed outside of Caracas, about 15 miles outside of Caracas, early one morning. Took a taxi 15 miles into town, and we could tell almost immediately that we were in a police state. It's Nazi, and it's hardcore. It's absolute dictatorship. You had soldiers standing around on the streets with arms on the hanging over their shoulders, with rifles and pistols on their sides. People were afraid to speak. They will not be able. They cannot read the Time magazine, the Life magazine, or the Newsweek magazine there, because the government will not permit it. There is a little station that we may be able to use just off the coast of Venezuela to reach these people. It's run by an American. At least I think he has an American name. His name is White, Mr. White. We have contact with him now by letter. We could not get to see him because it was on a Sunday when we tried to establish contact with him. But Caracas is booming. There's plenty of money, and they get it from you. A cup of coffee costs 40 cents, almost as much as a steak did in Argentina. We had to pay $20 a night for our room, and we didn't stay very long. We had to get out. A parking meter on the side of the street costs 35 cents. Our money. This is our money I'm talking about, American money. So we got out of this dictatorship as soon as possible and headed towards home, and it was good to be back when we got here. Now, I want to tie this in with what the Bible says now, as a way of ending to this little talk that I've given you. We know from Mr. Hayes' articles that these people are the descendants of Javan, or more specifically, Tarshish. And the Indian element in the population is the descendant of Tiras, T-I-R-A-S. I spell that out because there is a name in the Bible, Tiras, T-Y-R-U-S, that sounds almost the same thing. Now, knowing this, we can look through the Bible and see what the Bible has to say about these people. Now, tying this, what we find in the Bible, with what we know is going to happen in Europe, and knowing that Latin America is playing a supplying role to this beast power as it has played a supplying role to us in the past, can give us a new insight into what the
their role is going to be. Now let me turn to Ezekiel, just one second. Ezekiel 27. If you'll notice that this chapter starts out by saying, "Now then, son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyrus." Tyrus was a city located at the eastern end of the Mediterranean. Its population was composed of many races. It was a polyglot population, a population of many tongues. It was a nation, a city that can represent the system as it is existing today. Now let's read on down. Noticing down in verse 10, "They of Persia and of Lud and of Put." You can identify all of these by reading Mr. Hayes' article to find out what nations these people represent. Wait a minute, let me start over. "They of Persia and of Lud and of Put were in thine army, and thy men of war. They hanged the shield and the helmet in thee, and set forth in thy comeliness." Verse 13, "Javan," or Greece, "Tubal," Russia, "Meshach," North Russia, "they were thy merchants. They traded the persons of men and the vessels of brass in thy market." You will check Revelation 18, I believe it is, verse 13. You will see that this beast power is to rise up and to even deal. Let us read that. Revelation 18, 13. It's a new Bible. Having time to turn to what I want. 18:13. Well, let's go back up to 12. "The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood and all manner of vessels of ivory, all manner of vessels of most precious woods and of brass, iron and marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour, wheat, beasts and sheep and horses, chariots, and slaves, and the souls of men." In other words, if you will look in your marginal reference, you'll see that the bodies of men, just as it has said over here in verse 13 of chapter 27. Now, if you will skip down through this, you'll see in verse 14 that they speak of Togarma, which is China, and Syria, in verse 16, Judah, Damascus, Dan, Dedan, which is the Dodecanese Islands, Greece, or Javan, Arabia, Sheba, Rama. We can identify practically all of these from this article. Another thing that I want to point out is this. In verse 25, "The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy markets, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of the sea." This chapter is referring to the beast system. Panama, one of these nations that are in the Tarshish network or Tarshish curtain or behind the Latin system there in South America, has more ships registered under its flag than any other nation in the world, including Great Britain and the United States. The Republic of Panama offers the ship owners of the world very liberal tax terms, almost no controls over the working force of the ship. In other words, a ship owner that registers his ship in Panama can fly the Panamanian flag, pay a very small amount of tax, hire seamen all over the world for a pittance. Whereas if he registers in the United States, he has to pay a high tax here and pay union salary to the seamen that work aboard ship. So you can see why Panama would have the largest merchant fleet in the world. So then this prophecy ties this in, doesn't it? That the ships of Tarshish, and these nations all have merchant marines down there. "These ships of," excuse me, "did sing of thee in thy market, and thou wast replenished and made very glorious in the midst of thee." Think a bit. In Revelation, when the city of this great harlot is destroyed, the merchant seamen of the world are going to sit in lamentation because of the destruction that was wrought on this harlot over Rome. Now, let's drop down to, well, let's go on to verse 26. "Thy roars have brought thee into great waters. The east wind hath broken thee in the midst of the seas. Thy riches and thy fares, thy merchandise, thy mariners, thy pilots, thy caulkers, and the occupiers of thy merchandise, and the men of war that are in thee, and all thy company which is in the midst of thee, shall fall in the midst of the seas. When I noticed that this was tied in, first they were going to have a trade embargo. They were going to build this up. Now, I pointed out that Germany is building in Latin America and all the rest of the world in order to break us economically, to out-trade us, to put trade embargoes against us so that we can't trade, we can't sell. Now, I'm tying this in with Latin America because that's where I've just been, and that's my topic today. Latin America is to be part of this system, as you've seen up here in verse 13, Javan, which is a representative of the father of Tarshish and several of the other descendants. Javan is Greece. Tarshish is one of his sons. Now, the thing that is most interesting to us is this. We can prove from books that the observers of this world can point out this German machine, this German enterprise is building up, that is going to rise up to conquer the United States economically, then militarily, and then culturally, finally, if they could. But they can't do that because Christ will come before that, because there would be no place left if he did not come and intervene. But they're going to conquer us by economics, by trade. We can prove that and tie this in with Ezekiel 27 to show that the system is going to rise up to fit together and to conquer. Now, the thing that's interesting to us is, when can we take the gospel to these people? We can read in Matthew 24, verse 14, where this gospel that is preached by the church of God in this day will be carried to all the world for a witness. But only for a witness. If we can cover South America by radio broadcasts, I don't envision a great Latin American church populated by 10,000 of this country, 10,000 from this country, and 10,000 from that one. I envision a few people being called out of these people. I envision the broadcast going into many homes. They will hear it, do nothing about it. This is the witness that you and I are to do by our prayers, our offerings, and constant Bible study to fit ourselves into to do whatever we can do. Now let's turn over to Isaiah 66. Isaiah 66, if we read it carefully, stopping here and there to ask questions, will show us when this gospel is going to blossom out, not only to Latin America, but to all the world. To start it out, let's read verse 1 to find out who's talking. Thus saith the Lord. So we have the speaker. All right, let's drop down to verse 5. Hear the word of the Lord, you that tremble at his word. Who trembles at his word? The church of God trembles at his word. The Baptist church doesn't. A man on Market Street down here doesn't. Only the church of God should and does, I think, to a certain extent, tremble at his word. But we should all fear to transgress the law of God. We should open this Bible and read it and let it correct us and find out what's wrong with us, and to literally tremble to transgress God's commandments and what he has told us to do. Now, let's read on. Hear the word of the Lord, you that tremble at his word, your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake. We're to be persecuted, aren't we? During the tribulation, let the Lord be glorified. He shall appear to your joy. In other words, Christ will come to us that tremble at his word. He's going to appear, and we're going to be joyful at his appearance. At least we better be, or we can't stand in his presence. We better clean our house up so much that we will be joyful, be filled with joy at Christ's coming, so that we can stand in his presence. Now let's read on. A voice of noise from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice of the Lord that rendeth recompense to his enemies. Now, verse 8, who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such a thing? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day, or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Who is Zion? And who are the children of Zion? Zion is the church, isn't it? The children of Zion are the church, the children of God. The church is our mother. She has to travail to bring forth. And when does the church travail to bring forth? During the tribulations and at the coming of Christ. Because then we are born, you see. Those of us that are endure and are counted worthy to be there at that time. The dead shall rise. And those of us that are alive shall be changed. In other words, be born into the family of God. at that time. The church shall travail. Notice verse 12.
Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will extend peace to her like a river. In other words, to the church, or to his people in the kingdom. And the Gentiles, and the glory of the Gentiles, like a flowing stream. In other words, the riches of them. Let's skip down to verse 19. I will set a sign among them. Them here referring to the Gentile nations. Who is the sign? Christ is the sign. In one place in Isaiah, I believe it's Isaiah 11, he said that he would put Christ as an ensign to the people. All right. In verse 19 here, and I will set a sign among them, and will send those that escape of them into the nations to Tarshish to pull, to these Gentile nations and the rest of the world. Notice I was particularly interested in Tarshish and Javan here, because these are the Latin races. This is the time. First we have to preach a witness. Then, of course, there will be a few that are carried into captivity that will witness more to them. And then, after Christ has come, then the gospel will go out to these people. You can read in Zechariah 14, where we will be preaching the same gospel to these nations. And Egypt, as a symbol of the world, there is used. Because we're going to teach them the commandments of God. They're going to come up to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, which you and I will be doing in a short time in preparation for this. In other words, Egypt used as a symbol of the world. The whole world will send representatives up to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Then your work, your prayers, will have borne fruit. And our work now will bear fruit among the Gentiles as we can witness to them. But the real fruit will come later on when we are really able to witness effectively to them and force them to hear God's word and to keep the commandments by these supernatural signs and so forth. Well, let me thank you once again for your prayers and your letters. And it's so good to be back among you. And I'll be seeing more of you, I think.
The work is coming along all right. We certainly do need your prayers, but I think the work is all right at the moment. So far as I know, they're having the usual falling off at the last of the month. But we do need to continually pray so that it can grow to be able to reach these nations, as Mr. Ray was telling us, the possibilities about South America. The main need right at the moment is for the tabernacle, however, and I might mention that you should pray for that, and if any of you are able to help more toward that particular fund, I hope you will do so. We do want to get the tabernacle up in Gladewater. Some of our newer people might not realize what that's for or how it might benefit them, but we do have many of our annual festivals there for the people all through the South and Midwest and for all of us at Feast of Tabernacles time in the fall. So that is a particular need right now. I will say that we're being blessed very much, I think, with a wonderful incoming class this year of freshmen. We're going to have between 55 and 60, I believe. A few more keep coming and are being accepted, but we'll probably have around 55 or 60 new students. One of them is down here with us today with one of the older ones, Miss Donna Lou Fink, and it's coming this fall. I shouldn't say this fall, it's practically here already. We're starting in the end of the summer. But we'll be bringing them down, and I know that a lot of you like to meet all the students. It's going to be harder to do as the college grows, isn't it? Well, one particular thing I'd like to mention, before I do that, I'll make one other comment about the baptizing tours. Mr. Bryce Clark and Ernest Martin came in just a couple of days ago from their tour. I know that many of you have prayed for them and for the other men who've been out on tours. And they went through all of the eastern and northeastern part of the United States and a good part of Canada. And they baptized 170 people. They turned down very many and they were careful, but they baptized 170 people. So that is something we can be very thankful for. And they are safely and happily back. And I know that there were many times when circumstances worked in an unusual way to prevent them from having accidents and so on. They told me about some of them personally. And you do have God's protection in that way when you travel thousands of miles day and night if you're in His service, and sometimes you can tell it. There are, you know, time and chance happens to us all. And I know we all have our good breaks. But I've had good breaks before and bad breaks when I was in the world, but there are times when it just keeps happening day after day, and not just regarding protection on the highway, but just unusual occurrences continually, and let you know that God is with you. And He was with them on the tour, I'm sure. Well, the one thing that I wanted to ask you about particularly then, by way of announcement, is that Mr. Ted Armstrong and his wife Shirley have gone apart, away from their home, and they are especially praying at this time that God will heal their two sons. Many of you may know this already. There's nothing terribly wrong in the sense of some affliction, but both of their boys, at least the older one, they have three boys. Mark is the oldest, and then David, and then Matthew. And David is almost totally deaf, so far as they know. The doctors say the hearing mechanism is never formed. Now, whether the doctor knows, I don't know. I really don't know, and they're not sure either. It may have formed. They say that the nerve in the inner ear never formed properly, the bone. And actually the hearing mechanism is never formed properly. That's what the doctors say. And it also appears that their youngest son, Matthew, is in the same state. But it is growing bad for David, because David is getting up now. Let's see, he will be 2 years... Well, he was 2 years old, wasn't he? 2 years old in July. I was there at the time that David was born. It was in about July the 3rd or 4th. I think it was the 3rd of July. And so he's a little over 2 years old, and he's getting to the place where it's very awkward, because, you know, Mr. Ted Armstrong is the one who has written these articles and preached and believes with all of his heart in God's way of training children, but they're having a hard time training him because he can't hear them. You can imagine what that would be. He can't understand when they're trying to tell him to do something. And he's beginning to get the idea of certain things, but they're very limited. And after all, we should be praying for each other all the time for our various afflictions. And I think that it would be something that would help the whole church. Most of the Pasadena church knows about it. And it's something that I hope that you will take to heart and pray about a great deal. And especially at this time, for the next 2 or 3 days, because there'll be many people praying with you about it. I think that both those boys are deaf. And so I hope that you will join them in prayer, that God will heal them. Well, now, let's have a hymn, and then we'll continue. Would you all rise, please, and stretch?
Depart from evil, do what is good. Seek me, pursue it earnestly. Upon the just are the eyes of God. His ears are open unto their cry. But the eternal face is against them that are evil doers of wrong. He cuts remembrance off from them, cuts their remembrance from the earth. When righteous men cry, God always hears, for he delivereth them from fears. Near unto them of a broken heart, contrite spirit, God saveth them. Afflictions that we have, troubles there be of righteous men, but the eternal delivereth from affliction the righteous man. Depart from evil, do what is good, seek peace, pursue it earnestly. God keeps the bones of the righteous man, not one of them shall broken be. Though evil slay all unrighteous men, who hates the pure shall desolate be. But God redeemeth the soul that's his, none shall be desolate trusting.
This message is provided by the Bible Study website at address www.biblestudy.org and Barnabas Ministries. Bible Study. You have questions, the Bible has answers. Message introduction and closing by Dave Williams, digitizing and editing by Alan Ruth, and post-production by Mike Summers.